So here's my new latest idea.
Yeah.
I was thinking about Australian Aborigines, and I was thinking about the song lines, and I was thinking about the way that they use these complex stories and songs in order to basically keep track of the geography, you know, and the rituals that they have to go through or whatever, and how, so they have this story, and that story renders their experience coherent. And then I was thinking about this thing about, and I was thinking about rationalization and how we often engage, our consciousness often is largely simply rationalization of underlying preconscious stuff. So if it's really humid out and we're irritated because we didn't get enough sleep and somebody bumps into us lightly, we might get really pissed off because they bumped into us. But we're that's a rationalization, because we're actually pissed off because it's really humid and we didn't get enough sleep. So the proximate cause isn't the real thing. That's a rationalization is as anger and blame at this person, but the reality is that there's this preconscious stuff going on. And so this led me to the thinking about how we create these coherent story systems in order to comprehend, in order to so that we can understand in some way, to render coherent our experience. And what I was thinking about was how tonalities, each individual tonality, whether it's a raga or C major or a 12-tone row, that these are the way that the composer uses them, the composer is referring to a thing that he has in his mind that is one of these coherence creating scenarios. And this is, so there's this it's sort of pre-verbal coherence creating scenarios, and this is part of why we people who tweak with tonalities, which is to say people who take existing structures and start and become involved with manipulating them in new ways, which is a common thing for artists to do. It's easy to see in technology how artists will encounter new technology and they start manipulating different parameters of the technology to create new kinds of experience. And if you think about tonality that way, so then and somebody who's a certain kind of musician comes along and you're tweaking the tonalities, and the problem happens that when you do that, you can take them out of the coherent creating scenario that other people have, and then we run into the hostility.
That's interesting. So then what you have is, but then you're assuming that the listener to some extent has a musical coherence forming faculty.
Yes, I think that I do. I think that their life experience and their cultural background, and if they're a non-musician, and their training, certainly if they are a musician, creates in them this coherent creating scenarios. And those those kind of scenarios change drastically depending on who you are, where you are from, and what you encountered in your life. And so this creates the different types of music in the world, and creates the tensions that exist between different kinds of musicians, and it also creates the difference between people who are kind of closed-minded, who just want to stay within their coherence creating scenario, and people who are open-minded, who are willing to explore new experiences and listen to new tonalities, etc.
So let's look at a few ideas there in terms of you, because you're talking there about a psychological aspect, a musical aspect, and it's confusing to talk about cultural or ethno-musical stuff or whatever the musical output is in the world. So basically, you've gone through three kinds of things there.
Right.
Psychology and music faculty. I'm going to just jump in here. I'm not going to try to be mundane, but you know, if you talk about coherence, you know, my knowledge about coherence is really an issue. It comes from a certain set of Western composers that I think we should go back to your relationship to that kind of that line of thinking.
Yeah, well, I would say there's lots of different kinds of coherence, and accordingly, lots of different kinds of incoherence.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, a lot of times when jazz musicians play with Indian musicians, in spite of the, you know, that can be often a more rewarding experience for the jazz musician than it is for the Indian musician, because often the Indian musician isn't hearing the kinds of things that they think of as the things that give coherence within their realm of stuff. So they often, like, for instance, say, like, the guy is playing along, but he's playing outside of the rag,
mm-hmm.
you know, with, yeah. And like, for, you know, depending on the rag, that's something that an Indian musician would never do.
Right.
So that's what I'm talking about with that. With regard to the world that I came from, well, when I worked with Pat Carpenter and who studied with Schoenberg, and we spent a lot of time working on Schoenberg's concept of the musical idea, and a lot of time working on the concept of organic unity as it existed sort of in Vienna around that time.
Why were you interested in that?
First of all, I was profoundly drawn to the music.
It just sounded good to
me. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know,
In performance or from your training?
Let me start with this. The music that we studied in class was, you know, it was classic stuff. It was like Mozart. Remember, we spent a long time on the Mozart 40th first movement, and a lot of time on some Schubert songs and stuff, and then a lot of time on Beethoven sonatas, and the thing about it wasn't just, I mean, it was music that I had sort of liked and was drawn to, but when we actually started studying them in the way that, and analyzing them in the way that Pat Carpenter had evolved from the teaching of Schoenberg, as my friend Peter Schubert called it, it's like the light coming through the clouds, and these pieces became immensely richer, so that actually my experience of those pieces from developing those coherence creating scenarios and relationship to them became much, much more profound. And it also led me to this idea that there's this once again is one of these coherence creating scenarios, but that there's some ideas are more superficial and some are deeper, and which is a kind of, it might not actually be true, but it's part of my coherence creating scenario. And I was really drawn to this, the idea of like trying to come up with what's actually really vital, which often isn't necessarily the most complex, so that you could come up with an idea that then would create a piece of music that really draws you, the listener, in.
So what are these aspects that you would call that have vitality? I mean, how does vitality portray itself?
How does vitality portray itself? That's the difficult part to say.
Okay.
It's sort of the thing that it's very difficult to say, because it has to do with the idea for a piece, and if you have to do a certain amount of composing to get this sense, and you have to do a certain amount of composing and have things not work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, pieces that either you finish them and then you're like, oh, okay, well, that's not really that great, or pieces that don't manage, and this happens a lot, pieces that don't, you can't finish.
Well, yeah, because the idea is...
Because the idea doesn't have the right sort of way, it doesn't create enough scenario to give you the whole piece, you know. And when you study these old guys, you realize that their composers are full of pieces. I mean, their notebooks are full of pieces that aren't finished. And, you know, where they had the beginning of an idea, but the idea didn't have the juice, as it were, to really take off and manage to give up a whole piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the deal there is, it has to do with the idea that musical ideas have implication, and that the implication creates the need for continuation, which then gives continuity, which then gives this more kind of unified experience when you hear it. Of course, this is all within the realm of organic unity, which I believe these days is heresy in the postmodern era. But
why
but
do you say that?
Nonetheless,
what's the evidence? Where do you see that it's heresy?
Well, I recall Jonathan Kramer, a music theorist at Columbia University, in seminars talking about where do we go after organic unity? You know, like, this is the postmodern era. We've outgrown that idea, was the scenario, which I thought was kind of interesting because it's supposed to be postmodern, but the idea of outgrowing is modernist, so
mm-hmm.
that was kind of confusing to me. Also, it was confusing to me because I always thought that organic unity was something that you worked very, very hard to attempt to attain, not something that you simply learned and then, writing chord songs with 1, 4, and 5, you outgrow.
This, I take it, is when you were in for a doctorate. This is at
yes,
the doctorate.
Yes, when I was studying for a doctorate at Columbia University.
And you got the doctorate from Columbia in music education, right?
No, in composition.
It wasn't composition.
Yes,
I think
it was composition.
They weren't offering composition. Okay, good. So that and let me see now. But what was the scene around New York? Like, you were playing music around New York, and you weren't playing as a classical musician. Am I right? Is that the
That's
theory?
Right. I was in whatever genre you want to call them, punk, grunge, alternative, whatever kinds of things. I mean, there were a series of bands that...
Playing what instruments?
Mostly playing the bass and then guitar.
And this was around New York?
Yes.
At what point had you started playing bass and guitar?
My life?
Yeah.
I started playing the guitar at some ungodly early age. My father had a guitar laying around the house, and I don't know, so by 7 or something, I had the G and the D and the C chord together.
Very ungodly. I guess I was 7. And, okay, so you'd had that together, and you were...
But I mean, no, it was, but it's not like there was no skill involved.
Let me ask a question. Were you...
I remember I learned the little picking pattern for "It Takes a Worried Man," like, I think I was 10 or something. My
mm-hmm.
father showed me that. And
so your father was showing you music?
It's a little bit, yeah. He showed me enough to play guitar and play some folk songs and things on the guitar.
And did it have some kind of special interest to you?
Oh, yeah. I wanted to be a Beatle.
Okay, so that was what was the desire was at that point. And at 7, you were already like, the Beatles, man, that's the way to go.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I don't know how old I was when Help came out, that
uh-huh.
movie, but the scene where they all come back to the house and they all go into separate doors, but then they walk into one big giant room,
yeah.
and it has like a beverage vending machine in the room, that just blew my mind, and I was like, that's what I want in life, is that I want to be a Beatle.
So it was the social life that was going along with that you were into? Is that what it was?
Yeah, it was the whole thing. It was just,
uh-huh.
it was that I loved to sing those songs. Now, at the same time, okay, so it's like, there are parallel things. So I was playing the guitar, my grandmother wanted my father to either become, my father was a child prodigy, brilliant guy, Rhodes Scholar, 180 IQ.
Prodigious of what? Prodigy of what?
He was just one of these wonder childs. He was
whatever
he
did.
A violinist and also like valedictorian or whatever.
Where was he from?
He was from Seattle.
Seattle.
And so my grandmother wanted him to either grow up to be a concert violinist or the governor of Washington State.
You're fantastic.
Okay. And so my brother grew up to be a lawyer. and I grew up to be a composer, so I think this was sort of his way of settling up with his mother's desires.
Well, what did he grow up to become?
A philosophy professor.
Where?
At Columbia University.
At Columbia University. What was the impact? What now? His thinking. What kind of philosophy was he? Was he a practical philosopher, or was he a 20th century briefcase philosopher? The old excuse. Was he? What was he?
My father
what
was.
He up to?
Yeah. He's a okay. He's a very strange guy. He had gone to Reed. He fought in World War II, and then he'd gone to Reed College.
My father.
Yeah, he fought in World War II. And he was in Italy all the way from the bottom of the boot to the end of the war. Uh-huh. With the 34th Division, the division that saw the most combat days of any division in the history of the United States.
Wow.
I don't know what it's like now, though. This is right before, you know, we have this endless wars. And he came back, and he went to Reed, and I think you have to do like a thesis at Reed, and those are very good and very good school. And he did his the thesis, which is the equivalent of a master's now, on Collingwood and the philosophy of history. Then he went to Oxford on a Rhodes Scholarship, and in Oxford he was exposed to Wittgenstein and a bunch of other stuff, and he somehow switched from the philosophy of history to the history of philosophy. In the midst of all this.
You're funny because Wittgenstein would have hated that. It's very bizarre.
Well, here's what happened. I think he came back from England. He got to Columbia. I think that with Wittgenstein, he pretty much outgrew philosophy. And he was like, so he pretty much, he found himself, okay, now you're stuck with this, this is your chosen thing, but you're not really that interested in it anymore.
Okay.
He was also smart as all blazes. Uh-huh. He scared the hell out of everybody at Columbia.
Right.
But he just wanted to have a job.
Mm-hmm.
And so he saw that he had this opportunity to have a job and basically stay out of the way of the madness of the regular philosophers, you know. And so he took on the role of being the big guy in history of philosophy. Which, you know, he could treat just like it's a job. Sit at the desk for the next number of hours a day, pour through stuff, translate ancient Latin stuff, and do all this stuff that doesn't actually involve, like, that philosophy stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, which
mm-hmm.
can get to be quite unseemly, you know, especially in the days of the heyday of, the symbol guys and all that sort of stuff, the formalists
mm-hmm.
and the post-logical positivist sorts of things that were going
down. He didn't like that stuff.
He really didn't care for continental philosophy.
Uh-huh.
That is to say, he had no use whatsoever for Hegel and everything since. And he didn't really enjoy the activity of dealing with the P's and Q's, the ifs and thens and all that sort of stuff and creating little formulas. And so, but he wanted to have a job, so he decided to go into the history of philosophy, mm-hmm. and that he treated it like a job. I mean, it was like working at the factory for him. What he was really into was camping and skiing and playing tennis in the blazing hot sun and finding the world's cheapest, rattiest golf courses and filling a backpack full of stones and climbing up horrible steep hills. And, you know, this is what he was really into was his kids and his family and this outdoor life.
Do you think that was just in his nature, or his thinking led him to it?
I think his thinking led him to decide what was of value in life.
What was really
value. Yeah, and that's what he decided was really of value, and then he was stuck with this thing of being a philosophy guy. So he made himself the politically, he was chairman of the philosophy department, and then after he was chairman of the philosophy department, he invented this position called director of graduate studies, which allowed him to control the scheduling of classes. So that then he could arrange his schedule so he only had to actually go to work 2 days a week.
Mm-hmm. So he'd beaten the system in an incredible way.
So he devoted his intelligence.
He devoted his intelligence to defying the systems of Columbia University.
So that he could spend more time. So he could spend more time running around in the mud fishing with his kids. You know.
So. I wonder if the barbing chair who holds that position now utilizes it to the same.
I doubt it.
He's probably made himself excruciatingly busy and has no time to do anything.
Probably did not understand it all. I mean, my father had this, what I call, you know, he taught me this, the art of the Irish politician. You know, mm-hmm. where it's like, you get what you want, and nobody else even realizes that you've done it, you know, uh-huh. sort of thing.
Uh-huh. Was your father, was this Irish descent?
There was Irish. Mm-hmm. It was Irish, and there was a whole bunch of other crazy things as well. But
what was your relation to your father's ideas? I mean, did this stuff bleed into you at all? Or was
my relationship to my father's ideas, we argued, like, my brother, my father, and I argued incessantly every evening for hours.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother was the great rhetorician, and my father was the supreme challenger of semantics. And I, of course, used logic and reason to arrive at the right conclusions, while they, in their misguided... Well, you get the idea.
Right. Yeah. It's like everyone went to bed seething every night.
So the poor wives. They would just sit there in horror as we're ripping each other's bloody guts out, and they're like, "How can you do this to each other?" And we're like, "What? This is like we're having fun."
So I learned to.
He taught me also. Like, I was reading the dialogues of Plato when I was in high school, and he was teaching me how to follow the arguments and reason, and so I learned how to play that game.